Welcome to Madison Labor Radio. Labor Radio is dedicated to bringing news, information, and cultural events focused on working people and the labor movement to the Madison area and surrounding communities. I'm Gil Halstead, a former member of the Wisconsin Education Association Council and of the United Faculty and Staff. Your support is necessary to make Labor Radio and all the great programming on WORT possible.
Hi, I'm Annette Kuhlmann. Today we celebrate a historic win for labor with UAW get an on-the-ground report on this year's Labor Notes conference, learn about May Day preparations, and check in on labor struggles at Google and much more.
But who defend the workers who cannot organize?
As we approach May Day, the American labor movement has something to celebrate.
Workers at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee, delivered an overwhelming win for working people with a 2,628-985 vote for their union, the United Automobile Workers, or UAW. The union victory in this plant may augur success for the UAW's strategy to organize the other non-union auto plants in the South. This is no small task, as there are 13 automobile companies with 36 plants, the majority in the South. Next to vote is Mercedes-Benz, near Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The vote will take place between May 13th and 17th. The union drive at Mercedes-Benz is a test of the worker-driven, organizing strategy of the revitalized UAW. Sean Fain, the president of the UAW, offers a clear and exciting vision to working people. What follows is an excerpt of his speech at the Labor Notes Convention last week when he emphasized that the working class is the arsenal of democracy. Sean Fain, speaking at Labor Notes.
We put the membership in charge, and we remembered how to fight, and we remembered how to win. And then we noticed something after we won all this, and after this all happened, after we put the membership back in charge, we started to notice something else. Started out by the dozens, then by the hundreds, and then by the thousands. Non-union auto workers were reaching out to join our movement. You know, when I was campaigning for this job, I said a lot that bargaining good contracts leads to organizing success. It goes hand in hand. So the stand-up strike, it wasn't just about the big three. It was about the entire working class. And it was about proving one thing, that the working class can win. And we don't win by playing defense or reacting to things. We don't win by playing nice with boss. We don't win by telling our members what to do, what to say, or how to say it. We win by giving working class people the tools, the inspiration, and the courage to stand up for themselves. You know, in the 1940s, during World War II, the UAW members were building B-24 Liberator bombers at Willow Run plant. Those bombers were a big piece in the arsenal of democracy that helped defeat the fascists who were seeking to divide and conquer the working class. The UAW was responsible for creating the arsenal of democracy that led the U.S. to winning the war. And I said this at Willow Run on that day when the president visited us on the picket line, that, you know, we found ourselves facing a new enemy, a new authoritarian threat. But it wasn't some faraway country. It wasn't some other state. It was right here at home in our workplaces, and that enemy is corporate greed.
That was Sean Fain, president of the United Automobile Workers, speaking to the just-concluded Labor Notes Conference. I'm Frank Emsbach for Madison Labor Radio.
The Labor Notes Conference took place in Chicago over the weekend. Attendees were fired up and inspired after the UAW election win in Tennessee. Labor Radio spoke to several people who were there.
My name is Colin Gillis. I am a nurse and a member of SEIU Wisconsin.
My name is Andrew Cernatinger. I am a business representative for the Office and Professional Employees International Union, OPEIU, Local 39.
You attended the Labor Notes Conference recently. Can you tell us about the conference?
The Labor Notes Conference has been going on since roughly 1979. This is the largest conference they've had yet. It was about 4,500 people registered. The conference calls itself the troublemaking wing of the labor movement. It's primarily geared towards rank and file union members to train them on how to have democratic unions and how to engage in militant campaigns and make the labor movement more of a movement again.
Were there some inspiring sessions that you attended?
On Friday, I got to watch results from the Chattanooga Volkswagen plant election with UAW workers. And then on Saturday, I got to see the president of UAW, Sean Fain, celebrate that victory with all of us. Just getting to sit alongside 100 other healthcare workers who are active in their unions and compare notes about what's happening at their hospitals and what they've been doing to fight for their patients and their coworkers is really cool.
Two that struck me. One was about using social media to build the union. Starbucks workers talked a lot about the creative use of how they spread their message and beat back the anti-union campaign. Another one had to do with confronting remote work, which is all new since the pandemic.
What was the general tenor of the conference, would you say?
I've been to probably 7 labor notes. This is by far the youngest labor notes that I've seen. The youngest, most visibly queer, a lot of support for Palestine. I think there was just something in the air where people were feeling much more militant and prepared to confront work in the 21st century.
And how might this have an impact on organizing in Madison and elsewhere?
I hope it has a big impact in Madison. The ethos of Labor Notes is share the story and get the thread of a good example. So people talking about what they did and giving other people ideas like about how they could do the same thing.
The Minnesota Nurses Association added language to their contract that says that if you are a victim of a verbal or a physical assault while you're on duty as a nurse, you can leave before the end of your shift with no loss of pay. And then you can take up to 3 shifts off in the next 5 days without suffering loss of pay.
How can people find out more about it if they wanted to get involved?
Labor Notes is a publication primarily, so you can find their newsletter at labornotes.org. They hold a conference every 2 years.
How does the type of organizing that is espoused by Labor Notes different from the traditional types of organizing?
At its best, Labor Notes emphasizes ordinary people and their ability to really be the union and the capacity of everyday working people to solve their own problems.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I took from UAW, I took from Starbucks. Go on the offense, stay on the offense, treat every day like it's day one. Don't give up hope.
To the extent that people are willing to just start organizing themselves immediately in the here and now, not ask for permission and be willing to disrupt work in order to get the union they need. That to me is the future. And that's the best I saw at Labor Notes.
That was Colin Gillis and Andrew Cernatinger. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
Every April 28th is Workers' Memorial Day. Yesterday, the South Central Federation of Labor remembered workers who died or who were injured at work. Greg Jaboski reports.
Frank Wolfinger. Russ Norman. Andrew Stashik. Chandra M. Zimmer.
April 28th, a Sunday this year, is Workers' Memorial Day, when workers who are killed and injured on the job are remembered. On Thursday, on the grounds of the Labor Temple, the South Central Federation of Labor, or SCUFL, held its annual Workers' Memorial Day Remembrance, which included a reading of the names of those workers known to have died on the job in Wisconsin during the previous year. Kevin Gunluck, president of SCUFL, put the day in context.
Each day, more than 340 workers are killed, and more than 6,000 suffer injury and illness because of dangerous working conditions that are preventable. Our nation's job safety laws are too weak already, leaving many employers who violate the law unaccountable. OSHA penalties still are too low to be a deterrent. Employers retaliate against workers who speak out against unsafe working conditions. Black, Latino, and immigrant workers are disproportionately killed on the job. Heat, workplace violence, infectious disease, and chemical exposure.
A theme of this year's ceremony was the importance of unions in establishing and maintaining a safe and secure workplace. Gunluck described what workers face.
Workers still cannot freely join a union without retaliation from their employers. And yet, workers know that is the best way to improve their working conditions and make things safer for themselves, their coworkers, and their community. And we see that with unprecedented organizing efforts, workers wanting to join unions, form unions, and then fight for their rights to actually live and survive and be in a safe working environment.
Workers must be able to represent themselves, said speaker after speaker on Thursday. Tammy Burns, a pediatric ICU nurse at UW Hospital and a member of SEIU Wisconsin, reminded people of the realities faced by those who management called heroes during the 2020 COVID pandemic.
The nurses at UW have been fighting to regain our union since 2019. Little did we know at the time that we started this effort what was just around the corner with COVID. It's hard to forget one of the first emails that we got from our administration relating to COVID, telling us that we had no need to be wearing masks to work and this only scared patients. We would spend the next months to years fighting over things like access to PPE, access to paid time off if we caught COVID, being a part of conversations about policy changes related to COVID restrictions.
Labor Radio spoke to Kevin Gruber, a game warden and president of AFSCME Local 1215, one of the many public sector unions attacked under Wisconsin's Act 10. Gruber described the importance of bringing his union back to full legal power.
For us, we're willing to take calculated risks like our brothers and sisters in other public safety jobs. We're willing to take calculated risks to protect our natural resources and provide public safety. In exchange for that, we expect and demand a seat at the table and a voice in our working conditions. Here today, we're honoring those who've sacrificed, but our way of honoring them is to fight to regain our voice in our working conditions.
That was Kevin Gruber, president of AFSCME Local 1215. Workers' Memorial Day ended with the traditional playing of bagpipes by the Firefighters Union. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
Workers formerly employed by the tech giant Google spoke out this week against the company's heavy-handed response to internal dissent. Labor Radio has the report.
Scores of Google employees have been terminated in what they say is a clear retaliation for staging 10-hour sit-ins at two of the company's executive offices last week in an effort to force the company's divestment from a cloud computation contract with the Israeli government. The workers, who are organizing under the name No Tech for Apartheid, held a press conference on Monday to outline the events of the past week, as well as the motivations and demands of the organization. Zelda, one of the sit-in's participants, explained in their opening statement.
Last week, some of us engaged in an act of protest against Google for Project Nimbus, the company's $1.2 billion contract with Israeli military and government. We did so with three demands. Drop Project Nimbus. Address mental health and safety crisis of workers due to how their labor is being used without their consent. And end the culture of abuse, harassment, and discrimination against Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim workers.
While Google maintained that infrastructural services extended as a part of the contract, referred to as Project Nimbus, did not include services to the Israeli military, former Google employee Ray asserted that they mischaracterized the nature of the partnership.
Google has over and over again tried to redirect worker dissent by claiming that it's not a military contract, by claiming that it's not directed towards sensitive, classified, or military workloads relevant to weapons or intelligence services. We've known from the beginning that this is a mischaracterization of the contract. In the very first press release on Project Nimbus, the Israeli government announced that the contract was under the leadership of the Israeli military, the Israeli Ministry of Defense, along with other Israeli ministries.
The Israeli military has relied heavily on digital infrastructure like cloud computation and artificial intelligence to conduct its ongoing assault on Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. Reports by 972 and Local Call magazines, for example, have shed light on the state's use of an AI service called Lavender to rapidly generate lists of residences to target with unguided munitions, a service which, according to the magazines, has been programmed with a high tolerance for collateral deaths and deployed with rubber stamp level oversight by its human users since October 7th. Supporting such services, even directly, would fly in the face of Google's own stated AI principles, according to Google engineer and organizer Shane.
Google has tried to deny that they violate our principles by claiming that we're only working on the infrastructure supporting these technologies. But that to me seems like avoidance. When you know what your customer is doing, when you know what kind of technology they're using, when you're providing them technology that will aid and abet them in doing those things, even if they're just your standard suite of advanced AI services, you know what you're doing. You know you're being complicit.
9 employees were arrested and 28 were fired in the immediate aftermath of the sit-in. Some, like Zelda, were direct participants in the action, while others, such as an anonymous employee going under the pseudonym Oreo, said they were merely bystanders.
I'm a Palestinian-American ex-Google employee. I'm in a particular place of distress because I have family members in Gaza, but that's not what makes me special or what makes my case special. I'm not. What does make it special and unique is that I never participated in the sit-ins, and yet I still got fired with my colleagues who did. On the morning of, I went briefly into the building for a meet and greet, since I never met most of the team before. I said hello, I took a group photo with them, and I left shortly after and never went back to the building.
Since the initial wave of terminations, Google has fired an additional 20 employees proximal to the action, bringing the total number of affected employees to nearly 50. Zelda says that this has not blunted the group's resolve to see their work through.
Stay tuned for further action. We won't be backing down, and we're actually super busy now. So you'll see No Tech for Apartheid out and about at the college campuses, supporting the students who are doing incredible work in themselves standing up against the repression.
You have been listening to the voices of current and former Google employees organizing as No Tech for Apartheid. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Sean Hagerup.
The group Africa for Palestine, based in South Africa, has declared an International Week for Palestine starting May 1st, and Madison will be involved. Greg Jaboski spoke to a representative of South Africa's largest trade union federation about a week for Palestine.
Africa for Palestine, a nonprofit based in Johannesburg, South Africa, has declared an International Week for Palestine, which will take place in South Africa and countries around the world, including the U.S., with Madison being one of the U.S. cities sponsoring. Professor Farid Isak, a South African Muslim liberation theologian and professor in the study of Islam at the Department of Religion Studies at the University of Johannesburg, recounted at a press conference yesterday in South Africa some of the grim recent findings of the illegally occupied Gaza Strip and called the Western international community and its media to task.
Here we are, a day or two after the mass graves were uncovered in Gaza, containing nearly 300 bodies. Much of the international press is focused on three universities' protest actions inside the United States. And that gets the headlines in international media. Not a word or a whimper about the mass graves found in Gaza. And so in some ways, that is a reflection of the challenges that we face, but also on the importance of an initiative such as this.
Labor Radio spoke today to Matthew Parks, the Parliamentary Coordinator and Acting National Spokesperson for the Congress of South African Trade Unions, or COSATU, the largest labor federation in South Africa and a partner with the governing African National Congress and with the South African Communist Party in the tripartite alliance that has held power in South Africa since the overthrow of the apartheid regime and the establishment of a democratic government in 1994. COSATU is a sponsor of the Week for Palestine, as are the other members of the alliance. Parks lays out the reasoning behind the Week for Palestine.
It's an international solidarity week with the Palestinian people who have struggled for many, many years. It's a chance for the international community to kind of put a spotlight on the Palestinian people's struggles, to try to push for international solidarity with them, especially with some of the most influential countries in the world, like the United States. South Africans resonate deeply with the Palestinian struggle. I think South Africans see a lot of resonance in what the Palestinians are going through. You know, millions the Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, don't have the right to vote. Whether it's in Israel or Palestine, don't have the right to political freedom. When they see the Israeli Defense Force surrounding Palestinian communities, villages, towns, they see a deep similarity to what the South Africans went through during the apartheid era. And they see Palestinians not having the basic fundamental human rights that citizens across the world either enjoy or wish they'd enjoy. South Africans can relate that from the experience under the apartheid regime.
Parks explained the relation between COSATU and the ruling African National Congress and their support for the cause of the Palestinian people, and called on actions that the U.S. trade union movement can take in its powerful position inside a world power that directly funds and supports Israeli aggression.
So in South Africa, we have an alliance with the ruling party, the African National Congress, the former liberation movement, because of a variety of issues, because they support working class struggles and campaigns, because workers helped built the ANC and then it benefited. But of course, naturally, the ANC shares COSATU's international solidarity campaign with the Palestinian people. I think for us in the US, we would call upon the US trade union movement, which shows solidarity with the South African struggles during the apartheid era. You know, they called for boycotts, disinvestment, sanctions against the South African apartheid regime. They have solidarity campaigns and protests and so forth. We call upon the US trade unions to put pressure on their political parties, the Democrats, the Republicans, to tell the Israeli government to stop the war, to go to negotiations in good faith. I think we'd also encourage the U.S. trade unions to pressurize the U.S. administrations, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, to stop arms shipments to Israel, to put pressure on them. I think we'd also encourage the U.S. trade unions to even put pressure for sanctions, for boycott, and so forth, against the Israeli government.
There's Matthew Parks of COSATU. COSATU is a supporter of the Week for Palestine, which will self-sponsor events around the world, including Madison, from this Wednesday, May 1st through Tuesday, May 7th. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
The Case New Holland Tractor Company in Racine notified one-third of its workforce on April 1st that they would be laid off. Frank Amsbach has a reaction from the union.
Last year, UAW Local 180 struck Case New Holland in Racine for 9 months, essentially to redress long-standing wage and benefit deficiencies as compared to other agricultural equipment manufacturers. Labor Radio spoke with Yassine Mahdi, president of Local 180. As we began the interview, he indicated that the union suspected that the company might target the local. For one thing, the company resisted union demands for a 6-year contract, which in the union's view would represent stability. Secondly, the company has consistently reduced the number of product lines produced at the Racine facility, essentially taking it out of the supply chain of other crucial customers. On April 1st, the company announced permanent layoffs of one-third of the production workers. This so-called rebalancing came after Case announced stock buybacks and strong corporate profits. The work will be moved to Mexico. We asked President Mahdi to describe what he thought was behind the company's decision.
In my humble opinion, I believe that this is a retribution to striking for 9 months. When you look at all of the other facilities in, you know, the United States, we're the only ones that have raised a fight against the company for so long.
Consistent with that view is the company's attitude toward discussing any options with the union. President Mahdi.
I don't believe the company would entertain any type of compensation or any type of government assistance to keep production here. I believe that this is a direct result of us standing up to them.
Organizing is the only possible way out, explains President Mahdi.
Another priority should be is unionizing all of the North American plants. So, you know, if we can reach out to the customer, ultimately the farmers that buy the product, and unionize the plants that still have no union representation within CNH, I think that that may slow some things down, but ultimately it's very tough to compete with Mexican wages.
That was President Yassi Mahdi of Local 180 UAW. I am Frank Emsbach for Madison Labor Radio.
This Wednesday, May 1st, is International Workers Day. Wisconsin will have back-to-back marches on May 1st and May 2nd in Milwaukee and Madison. Greg Jaboski spoke to some of the organizers.
Wednesday is International Workers' Day, May 1st, also known as May Day. The immigrant rights group Voces de la Frontera will again sponsor a May Day march in Milwaukee. And, in what has become a new tradition, a march organized mostly by high school students will be held the next day, May 2nd, in Madison. Labor Radio spoke today to some of the organizers of the marches. Stephanie Salgado, the Madison organizer for Voces de la Frontera, described Wednesday's march in Milwaukee.
On May 1st, as the International Day of the Worker, we are striking, we are marching in Milwaukee, all the way from Voces de la Frontera's offices to the Surf Forum in Milwaukee between 10 to 11 to 12. Our main demands are workers' permits for all workers, ending 287G, at racist law that allows the collaboration between prisons and immigration, ICE specifically. We're also demanding for a complete ceasefire in Gaza, and we're also demanding driver's license for all workers in the state of Wisconsin to be reinstated.
And for a third year, there will be a march on Madison on May 2nd, largely organized by student leaders. Mary Acosta is the president of Raza United at East High School, and Saliam Vasquez Colon is also a high school student and a student leader with Raza United. Acosta talked about the May 2nd march.
The May 2nd march is going to actually start from two starting points. We have one starting from East High School and another one from West High School. We're going to start the march around 10, and we're going to march to the Capitol, and we're going to get there around 11:30. We have about over 20 Latinx organizations in Madison and also some Perry, Monona, and Middleton. Also Verona, another around Madison, who are going to be joining us to this march, and we have an expectation of around 1,000 students attending.
Vasquez Colon and Acosta describe some additional student demands for Thursday's march.
We're also demanding for work permits, ending 287G, state driver's licenses, accessible education, free lunch for all students, and to fight for Palestine. Or we're trying to get America to send ceasefire and aid into Palestine. And we also have a lot of our Muslim students working with us to educate some of our other students on what's going on in Palestine.
Last year, there was wide participation by Madison Public School teachers and staff in the May 2nd march with support from its union, Madison Teachers Incorporated, or MTI. Acosta and Salgado look forward to marching beside their school teachers and staff, though they note the pressures they face.
Teachers actually have the choice to join or not. However, they are supposed to call in sick. Last year, we had a lot of Latino staff members in our schools who also joined in. The issue is that they also have to be in school.
And I also contacted the teachers union in Madison, and so far support was very positive. They said, like, I will pass this to all the members. But again, like kind of what Maddie said, it is very up to them on how they want to navigate, considering they could be facing retaliation with their work security.
So Stephanie Salgado, Voces de la Frontera, and student leaders Mary Acosta and Saliam Vasquez Colon. The May Day march on Wednesday in Milwaukee starts at 10 a.m. at Voces de la Frontera offices at 1027 South 5th Street in Milwaukee. The May 2nd student-led marches in Madison start at 10 a.m. leading to the Capitol from both East and West High Schools. For more information, see the Voces de la Frontera website at vdlf.org. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
Thanks to editor Frank Emsbach, assistant Robin G., copy editor Simon Gordon, reporters Greg Jaboski, Carol Weidel, Sean Hagerup, Janine Ramsey, Bryant Novinska Lois, and damage control specialist Joanne Powers. And special thanks to Keith Steffen, our reader coordinator, engagement editor Alice Herman, and to all of our readers and the members of IBEW Local 2304 WORT Staff Collective.
And I'm Annette Kuhlmann. We would also like to thank all of the generous contributors to Labor Radio and WORT. Please stay tuned for the Blues Cruise with Dave Watts and the Professor Bill Clark.